3rd to Sunday, August 14th. After being sold as a slave, Joseph is taken to Egypt, where he interprets Pharaoh's dreams and saves Egypt from a famine. Music includes Close Every Door to Me, One More Angel, Any Dream Will Do, and more. Ticket information is available at 1-888-261-9675.
Good morning and welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Producing the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. In this part of Focus 580, we will be talking with Jim Wallace, someone who is quite well known as a public theologian, a nationally renowned preacher, and faith-based activist. He is founder of Sojourners, Christians for Justice and Peace. That was actually more than 30 years ago, and continues to serve as the editor of Sojourners magazine. In 1995, he was instrumental in forming Call to Renewal. This is a national federation of churches, denominations, faith-based organizations from across the political and theological spectrum, all of them interested in working to overcome poverty. He does an awful lot of speaking across the country around the year, has appeared in print form as a columnist in New York Times, Washington Post, LA Times, and other papers, has led many town meetings, particularly in recent years, trying to bring together people, religious people, civic and business leaders, elected officials, all of them in the interest of talking about social justice and moral politics. And he's the author of a book that was published not very long ago that has gotten quite a bit of attention. The title of the book is God's Politics, and the subtitle says it all. It's Why the Right Gets It Wrong and the Left Doesn't Get It. The book is published by Harper San Francisco, and if you're interested in reading it, you can go out in the bookstore and look for the book, or go to the library and look for the book, and you can find it. And of course, questions are welcome here. We'd like to involve people in the conversation. The only thing we ask is that people just try to be brief, and we ask that so that we can get in as many people as possible and keep the conversation moving. But of course, people are welcome to join in, and they add an awful lot to the show. So here in Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to call, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. So at any point here, if you have questions, you are certainly welcome to give us a call. Mr. Wallace, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
I'm good.
Good, very good. I'm really glad that you could give us some of your time.
Sure.
Just as a couple of large questions first, I'm sure that there are many people who would identify themselves as Democrats or as liberals who also consider themselves to be people of faith. And if you ask them a question like, are moral issues, are values issues important to you? They would say, well, yes, of course they are. Having said all that, how is it that it is the Republican Party that is the party of values?
Well, it's been an amazing experience to go across the country on this book tour, and they've been town meetings disguised as book signings and revivals in bookstores. And what I've learned is that a lot of people have seen the way religion was used and many would say abused in the last election, or the way it's been portrayed in the media, or the way it's invoked in the corridors of power here in the White House and the Congress, and they say, wait a minute, I'm a person of faith too, and that's not my faith. That doesn't speak for me, or I care about moral values as well, and those aren't all my moral values. So I'm meeting all these people around the country who have felt left out of this conversation and who don't respond to the shrill tones of the religious right or the kind of disdainful attitudes of some on the secular left against people or people of faith or religion. And so they're wanting to have their voice heard. And so you make a good point. How did the Democrats, which were linked just a few decades ago to a civil rights movement led by black churches, become now the secular party, so-called, or even hostile to faith? Part of that's unfair. There are Democrats who are people of faith. I meet them up on the Hill, in the Senate, in the House, as well as Republicans who are people of faith or aren't people of faith on both sides. But I think the Democrats and the progressive side has conceded the entire territory of religion and values to the religious and political right over these last few decades, which I think is the biggest mistake they've made. And so on this book tour for God's Politics, a lot of people are saying it's time to take back our faith.
Mm-hmm. I know that I'm sure that there are some people who would point out just how how effectively organized conservative evangelicals have been, and the fact that the Republican Party has done a good job of appealing to them and using them, having that is, after all, a very significant part of their base. And I suppose that some people would say that one of the shortcomings of the Democrats is that they have not had a parallel kind of effort. Now, one might also say, how much does that have to do with the fact that if there are people who would identify as liberal evangelicals or liberal people of faith, that somehow they're not as organized, they don't have as concise an agenda as conservative evangelicals. So I guess I'm wondering, you know, to what extent it has to do with the religious community and how organized it is and how willing it is to become involved politically, that as compared to or alongside the ability of the parties or what the parties have done to
right.
try to connect with those people as potential voters and as a significant part of their base.
Good question. Well, the religious right was the idea of the political right. Some political operatives had this idea for capturing a constituency, and they had some meetings, and they made some deals, and they said, give us your lists, and they aimed their computers at those lists to build a constituency for political power. So it clearly was a politically motivated sort of effort. And yet there are more moderate religious congregations, or even progressive ones, then there are those who are identified with the religious right. But you're correct. The other side, the right, is much more organized. They've been doing this now for 30 years. That's what's changing, and that's a good sign. The first thing, though, is to talk about the message. And see, I'm an evangelical Christian, too. So when the right says there are only two moral values in politics, abortion and gay marriage are the only moral values issue, as an evangelical Christian, I want to say back to them, when I find 3,000 verses in the Bible on the poor, I insist fighting poverty is a moral values issue too, or protecting the environment, otherwise known as God's creation, is a moral values issue as well, or the ethics of war, whether we go to war, when we go to war, and whether we tell the truth about going to war are profoundly religious matters. So we have to broaden and deepen the moral values conversation. And when we do, we find lots of people who do think, as I do, that values ought to be the discussion about the future of American politics. But the question is whose values and what values and how ideologically or in a partisan way will those values be defined. Religion is not supposed to be finally a wedge to divide us and destroy us, but something that can come across bridging our differences. Bridges, I think, are what's needed now more than wedges.
Yeah, I think that gets at a really important and maybe subtle point about this whole issue of values and voting.
Right.
Because right after the election, there was a lot of attention paid in the media to, you know, they asked people after they had cast their vote when they were coming out about who they voted for and why and what was important to them. And we saw all these stories that said that they were particularly important to the president were people who talked about values being important. So there were all these stories about values, voters, and their influence.
Right.
And then, however, when people started to do a more careful kind of analysis, asking questions, all right, what do you mean by that? If we just take people who say yes, values are important to me, and then we start asking them what do you really mean? What values are important? Then the picture became much more interesting and also much more complicated when you started to look at what people really thought were important and what were the big issues. And the picture started to look kind of different than it did just the day or two after the election.
It really did. It was fascinating because the first poll was an exit poll. And the exit poll asked, what did you vote on? And there were one category was called moral values. And then the other categories were things like Iraq, terrorism, health care, education, and so on. Well, when you separate values from issues, you forget that values are embedded in issues. So that if I was a Christian who thought the war in Iraq was wrong, I probably would have checked Iraq on that poll, and it would have been, for me, a deeply held religious and moral value. Or if I was a Catholic coordinator of a soup kitchen, food pantry, I would have checked whatever the closest thing was to poverty, which would have been a moral value for me, too. So it mixed apples and oranges, issues and values. When a Zogby poll came out, as you say, a week or two later, it asked the moral question straight up and more clearly. It said, what is the greatest moral crisis facing America? And fully 62% of those who were polled either said greed and materialism or poverty and economic justice. About 16% said abortion, about 11% said gay marriage. So when the issue was asked in a fresher, clearer way, the moral values issue wasn't then restricted just to abortion and gay marriage, which is how the press interpreted that first poll. The moral values voters voted 80% for George Bush, and that means they were concerned about these one or two issues, which are important issues. And on these town meetings, we're finding real common ground, even on the contentious issues of abortion and gay marriage and family. But what we're saying is these aren't the only issues. And we've had a tremendous response from people in now 57 cities who want to have a deeper values conversation. I think it's a good thing when Americans vote their values. But the question is, how broadly or narrowly will that be conceived?
Yeah, that seems to be what's a little bit troubling, is that the values conversation that we're having seems to be so closely focused on the hot button issues,
right,
and perhaps the most contentious, the ones that people, you know, can get you in an argument soonest, mm-hmm, having to do with abortion, having to do with gay rights, and to some extent also we've seen some discussion of end of life kind of issues.
Mm-hmm.
And though what's really kind of troubling is that it seems that, as you say, that not to say those things aren't important and they're not things that are on people's minds. If you ask this question, what are the kind of values issues that have a much more broader penetration and more and more people concerned about them, you come up with these other things, and then you ask the question, are those things on the agenda? Are they being discussed? And sad to say, it seems that the answer is no, they're really not.
And where the right, the subtitle to the book, where the right gets it wrong, is while the right side of the political spectrum is comfortable with the language of values and religion and faith and God, they do narrow it to a couple of those issues. And the left gets, how the left doesn't get it, the other part of the subtitle, mm-hmm, is it gives away the values conversation entirely to the right. And it says people should vote on the basis of their economic self-interest or some other criteria, not values. So the widening and deepening of a values conversation is the key to America's political future, because I want people to vote all their values and not be have that defined in such a narrow partisan way. And so I'm feeling that all over the country. We've had a terrific time, and we've met lots of people, and we've had just very lively conversations. Probably half the audience, we've talked to, let's say, 80,000 people directly in 57 cities, and half the audience is under 30. And they don't care about the liberal, conservative, left-right categories. They want to know what's right and what works, and they want an agenda for their lives that's worthy of their energy, their time, their gifts, their commitments. And so I got to tell you, I'm very encouraged by the way people are looking for bridges and not wedges, and the way people are hungry for not a politics of fear, but a politics of hope.
We have a caller to talk with, and perhaps just very quickly, I will introduce again the guest for this part of Focus 580, Jim Wallace. He is well known as a public theologian, faith-based activist. He's authored a number of books. He's the founder of Sojourners. It's a nationwide network of progressive Christians. He serves as editor of Sojourners magazine, which deals with issues of faith and politics and culture. He's the convener of Call to Renewal. That's a national federation of churches and faith-based organizations that are interested in working on poverty by changing the direction of public policy. And he's authored a book that you might like to look at. It's been out now for a couple of months. And the
six months almost.
It was in January, actually, when it was published.
Right.
But he's continuing to talk about these issues, and it's gotten a lot of attention. And the book is titled God's Politics, Why the Right Gets It Wrong and the Left Doesn't Get It. And it's published by Harper San Francisco. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. We have a caller here in Lovington. That's line number one. Hello.
Morning.
Yes.
I haven't read your book, and I've just been listening to you for a little bit, so I have no idea what you really think about my comment, and I hope you have something to say about it. But I think one of the biggest problems with religion in the United States, and as far as the far right wing is, there's a lot of I live down here in the middle of nowhere, and there's a lot of people down here, as I think, that are in love with faith. I question whether they have faith. I think they just really like believing in stuff more than anything else, and I believe that their preachers and leaders kind of feed into it, and they want simple answers, and they want to believe in them, and I think that's part of what the Republican Party's got right. You don't give anybody a honest answer, you give them a short answer. And I think from what I know of people around here that really are what I'd call, evangelical. I mean, I've been to some of these church services, and I have a hard time. I've read the Bible several times, and I have a hard time recognizing a lot of the stuff that they're talking about as being in the Bible. More like propaganda to feed into the vote against abortion.
Mm-hmm. Well, you raised good questions here. I think clearly, religion can be dumbed down or can be reduced to providing simple answers, short answers, and less than honest answers. And it's worse, religion has been used. I'll say this as a religious person, it's been used often for some of the worst things we've done to each other in history, justifying them and doing them even worse yet in God's name. Yet religion and faith have also been catalytic and mobilizing and inspiring most of our major social reform movements in this nation's history, from the abolition of slavery to women's suffrage, child labor law reform, and of course, famously, civil rights, were fueled and led in large part by religion, by people of faith. So we have a good history, but also some not-so-good history. And I feel the way you do when I hear things that I don't even recognize. Like, how did Jesus become pro-rich, pro-war, and only pro-American?
I heard a Bible story to that effect, and I said, well, where'd you get that out of the Bible? That basically the rich man must have done something right in God's name or something.
Yeah, and it just, I was on the Jon Stewart show on that Daily Show, and he said, now, Jim, you want to apply, like, religion and the words of Jesus, like, to politics? And I could feel his youthful audience around the country saying, oh, no, he's got some wacko evangelical on my favorite show. He's going to ruin it. And I said, well, John, yeah, but I don't think Jesus' two top priorities would have been a capital gains tax cut and the occupation of Iraq. Hmm. And so you get that impression sometimes from some on the religious right. So Jesus might not recognize himself in the way he's being invoked by so many people. So that just means we need a better, let's do a more honest reading of what our traditions say and try to be more faithful in applying it.
Well, I think part of the basic problem is, across the board, religion, whatever, I think most people in this country, the vote, are pretty unaware of what they're voting for.
Yeah, and that's always a challenge in any democracy, that we in D.C. where I live, you live in the middle of nowhere. I live inside the Beltway. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you what happens here. The politicians of both sides, they do this. They take an issue, and they do two things. They want to first make us afraid of it, then they want to blame it on the other side. Then they take a poll to see who won, and the election is just the last poll. They never get back around to solving the problem. And then the media makes things worse by acting like every issue has only two sides, mm-hmm. Left and right, liberal, conservative. Well, I work on issues like youth violence. There's no left-right there. There's many people and players and constituencies that you have to get involved to find a solution. So America's hungry for a politics of solutions, not a politics of blame, and a politics of hope instead of a politics of fear. But the short answer, which you talked about before, a short, simple answer is who to blame and what to be afraid of. And often politics ends there. But real politics goes deeper and says, how do we solve these pressing issues that really impact the quality of our lives? And that, I think, for that, religion doesn't have all the answers. But I think the religious community has to play a positive role in that search for solutions.
Thank you.
All right, thanks. I guess I'm thinking once again about just how polarized, let us take among people of faith, how polarized the conversation about some of these most polarizing issues can be. And when you get people talking about things like the right to die, about homosexuality, about abortion, maybe other sorts of things, it seems that there, I guess I find myself wondering, is it really possible, say, among people of faith who are really committed to these issues and who are really find themselves on opposite sides, is it really possible for there to be some kind of middle ground where people can find some common ground?
Well, it's really challenging, I'll grant you that. But having traveled the country now back and forth for these 20-some-odd weeks, it really is, I think, possible. For example, let's take a couple of the tough issues. I think that a lot of pro-life and pro-choice people, to use those simple and not very helpful categories, could come together in a serious effort to dramatically reduce the abortion rate in this country, which is way too high for a caring society that cares about women and children. So how do we really, you know, this very Hillary Clinton called it tragic, always a tragic choice, Senator Clinton said, and I think most people agree with that. She wants to maintain the legal right to abortion, but she said it's a tragic choice. How do we really dramatically reduce the abortion rate? By working on teenage pregnancy, adoption reform, supporting low-income women, which always reduces the abortion rate. We could do that together, and instead of arguing symbolic moral positions, try and find some solutions and make abortion really rare in this country. I think that's possible. And I'm talking to members of the Congress on both sides about how that might be done. So I think most Americans would respond to that kind of common ground. Now, maybe the extremes on each side wouldn't, but most, I think, would. And my experience is that they are. On the gay marriage question, you know, I think gay marriage got used as a surrogate for caring about family in the last election. To vote against gay marriage meant you were for family. That's the wrong surrogate. So I went out to the Focus on the Family in Colorado Springs, James Dobson's group, and had a conversation with them. And I said, you know, I'm with you all on the importance of family and marriage and raising kids. I'm a father of a six-year-old and two-year-old, two boys. And parenting is the best job and hardest job in America. And when I say that parenting has become a countercultural activity in America, all parents nod their heads, whether they're liberal or conservative. And I said, so I'm all for your concern about the breakdown of the family as a serious crisis, but please explain to me how gays and lesbians are the ones responsible for the breakdown of our families. And after an hour and a half, they conceded the point and said that family breakdown was due much more to heterosexual dysfunction than gay and lesbian people. So it's possible to be pro-marriage, pro-family, pro-kids, and really mean that and talk about family-friendly policies that would support marriage and parenting and kids, and still be also supportive of gay rights at the same time. Pro-family and gay rights are not contradictory commitments, and I think we can do both.
We have some other callers. Let's talk with someone in Charleston, line number 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes. It's good to hear from someone that I can agree with. I think my biggest problem is that whether I'm talking politics or practically any issue, it seems as if instantly I'm expected either be right or left. What happened to the category of the middle, which you used to even read about in the papers, hear about on the radio or TV? And I don't know when I've heard any word that indicates middle of the road as far as any of these issues go. I'll hang up and listen to you.
Well, I think a lot of people find themselves in the same place that you are. And I even have a, you know, how we could even go better than middle. I'd like to talk about the moral center of our public discourse. What's the moral center of politics? How do we not just go to the middle, but go deeper and talk about the moral issues at stake in any political battle? And what happens is you kind of move away from left and right, and you go to a deeper kind of place. And so I think a lot of people are looking for solutions, and they're wanting some kind of moral language that can critique both left and right and offer some better alternatives. And I think a lot of people are just waiting for that kind of voice. I just had a meeting in my office here in Washington, D.C., with a whole bunch of people who care about families and children, and that's their focus. And they said it's so hard to get anything bipartisan going right now in this very divisive Congress on even something like what's happening to our children. And so I think we have to, in outside the Beltway, where I spend most of my time, we've got to build the kind of social movements, and the best ones, I think, always have spiritual foundations to them, that really can hold our political leaders accountable for answers, solutions, and outcomes, not just blaming, and to say, how do we, you know, it's not acceptable in the richest country in the world that our poverty rate is going up, unlike so many other places around the world. One of five of our children are still poor. One of three children of color. That shouldn't be acceptable to any of us. So what are some effective effective means to change that reality? And that should, overcoming poverty, for example, should be a bipartisan issue and a nonpartisan cause.
Let's go on. We have next someone in Champaign. This is line number 2. Hello.
Hi, Jim. I'm actually reading your book right now. I have a question about a little more about the denominations and the Christian landscape in America.
Mm-hmm.
About 5 years ago, I wrote an article where I was trying to identify trends in Christianity, kind of inspired by Bishop Spong, just the title of his book, Why Christianity Must Change or Die, and trying to figure out, you know, what exactly was going on denominationally in America. And a lot of the things I was hearing from different pastors and theologians was that there seemed to be kind of a divide forming between more conservative and more liberal denominations and identities within Christianity. And I don't know, I guess I was wondering what if you could speak on that. And what I mean by the divide is being more political is that for example, the mainline Protestant denominations, you know, being strongly identifying with some of the more progressive movements in politics, ordaining homosexual clergy and, you know, women's rights and things like that, versus the more neocon, traditional evangelical groups. And I don't really know if you would say that that's an accurate observation, but I wondered if you could see that, you know, 5 years later, if you still see Christians kind of dividing along those lines, and where you would see this new group of, or maybe not so new, but this group of Christians who don't identify with the left or right fitting in terms of denominations.
Yeah, good question. That's the conventional wisdom, that evangelical liberal split. I don't find that to be true, and here's why. There are a growing number of what you'd call evangelical progressives. I'm one, for example, and I'm not. There's a whole younger generation of, you know, young evangelical students at places like Wheaton College up near, west of Chicago, and I've been there recently on the book tour, and They're very evangelical. This is Billy Graham's alma mater, and yet poverty is becoming a big issue there, and the environment, caring for the environment, they call it God's creation, is a big issue there as well. And so I think those categories are breaking up some. Sojourners Magazine, where I work, is is a magazine that talks about the intersection of faith and politics and culture. And we really have maybe a third evangelical, a third Catholic, a third mainline Protestant in our readership, and our Sojo Mail, which is a weekly email newsletter, it goes to about 200,000 people, and it's growing. Its list has doubled in the last year. It's growing, and it really defies those old categories. So there are very right wing evangelicals, and there are very progressive evangelicals, and lots of moderates. And I think indeed that the future of the country politically will probably be determined by, I would think, evangelical and Catholic moderates who are not really in the pocket of the religious right, nor are they going to respond to a religious left, but they really care about some of these big issues, and they're going to look for who speaks to their concerns, and the Democrats haven't been able to reach them in recent times. And I think, though, that they could. I mean, Jimmy Carter was an evangelical himself, and still is, and was a Democrat, and very successful. And he got more than 40% of that white evangelical vote. That wasn't the case this last time around, when John Kerry got 21% of that same white evangelical vote. So I think those people are really looking for some vision and for some answers. But I find the old categories of all the evangelicals are conservative, all the mainline Protestants are liberal, that just isn't really true anymore.
Do you think that has any implications for the future of denominational divides in Christianity? I mean, do you think the landscape of Christianity will change because of that? I mean, more people coming together, possibly denominations blending, things like that?
Well, I think, I work with most all the denominations, and I think they've got some huge battles, and often over these very divisive issues we were talking about a moment ago, however important the issue of homosexuality and gay marriage and all that is, nobody could say that it's so important it should take 80 or 90% of the time of an annual gathering of a church body. You got a war raging. Wars around the world, you got Darfur, you got people starving, you got genocide going on, you've got 1 billion people living on a dollar a day. So it's hard to believe that religiously homosexuality should consume the majority of the debate time. But that's what's happened in these denominations. So how do you change that conversation? How do you call a ceasefire on some of the divisive issues? Learn to live with some differences for a while on some of those issues that won't be sorted out this year and next year, and focus instead on some of the big issues that could really draw us back together again. I think there are a lot of issues that bring us together, and those that we're going to have to live with differences for some time.
Thank you very much.
All right, thanks. It seems to me that also is a big question is not only how do you change the conversation on the local level, say, like on a congregational level, but how do you change the conversation nationally?
Absolutely.
And I think some people would say that since September 11th, 2001, the administration has been very good at keeping the focus of the conversation on security issues and on terrorism. And that's not to say that those aren't important. Of course, those are important. But that they've managed to keep the focus on that conversation and then perhaps a few other things that they consider to be important. And, it makes me think about the old cliche about, turning the supertanker around. I mean, to get the agenda to get onto some other subject, to get the things to change, this is not easy. How do you get some kind of public, a more significant public dialogue going on different sorts of issues if you think there are other things that we should be focusing on?
Well, that's... What the book talks about again and again is how, at least I believe, that what changes history are social movements. If you look back, that's what's always done it. Lyndon Johnson didn't become a civil rights leader until Martin Luther King Jr. made him one. So it's social movements that change politics and politicians. And the best social movements are the ones that have a spiritual foundation. So I think in the book I use this image of that you can tell who the politicians are on Capitol Hill, because they're the ones walking around with their fingers up in the air, and every once in a while they lick their finger and put it back up in the air to see which way the wind is blowing. And then we think that by replacing one wet-fingered politician with another, you can change a country, and that doesn't happen. We get disappointed and discouraged. And the leaders of the social movements like Martin King and Gandhi and others knew that you change a nation not by replacing one wet-fingered politician with another. You change a nation when you change the wind. Change the way the wind is blowing. It's amazing then how quickly the politicians do respond. So I think, for example, if you had a concerted effort around the country, the religious community coming together and others too and saying the best test of a nation's integrity is how we treat the poorest and most vulnerable among us, particularly our children. How are we treating our children? What are the God question, I would say, is how are the kids doing? Well, we have the greatest gross national product in the world. Well, fine. How are the kids doing? Well, we have this military firepower unmatched by anyone else. Well, how are the kids doing? There's some big questions that should pull us back together, and I think if we created those kind of social movements in the society, the politicians, they do tend to respond to public momentum when it moves one way or the other. But that's our job, is to be, I think, what the book says is we have to learn how to be wind changers and not just lobbyists.
We have about 15 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. We have a number of callers. We'll try to get everybody in the time that remains. I do again want to introduce our guest. We're talking with Jim Wallace. He is the founder of Sojourners. It's a nationwide network of progressive Christians. He serves as editor of Sojourners magazine. He's also convener of Call to Renewal. It's a national federation of churches and faith-based organizations that are working to confront poverty by changing the direction of public policy. And he's well known as a speaker, spends a lot of time traveling around the country, talking with groups and talking in town meetings. He's been interviewed a great deal in the media, radio, and television, in part because of this book that we mentioned that came out earlier this year that's titled God's Politics, Why the Right Gets It Wrong and the Left Doesn't Get It. That's the title. And the subtitle is published by Harper San Francisco in the bookstore, if you would like to read it. And we have now several people here who would like to talk with us. We'll go to a caller in Chicago and line one. Hello.
Hello. I want to make a couple comments in response to what the guest has said. First of all, when you talk about various different issues regarding faith and public life, I think the reason certain issues get more attention is that the they're more clearly identifiable. For instance, when you talk about moral issues, it's very clear abortion has always been considered immoral by various traditional religions, not just Christian, but Judaism, and Muslims. And so these are clear-cut issues. Homosexuality is the same thing. But when you talk about poverty and war, they're not always that easy to apply a solution to. For instance, the just war theory exists, but it's not always that easy to apply. Even among conservatives during the Iraq War, many conservatives were opposed to the war in Iraq, even the Pope. But yet, you had others who were for it. So these issues do not always have a clear solution, and that's why I think more focus gets put on the more clear-cut issues. And the second point I wanted to make was that when you talk about, Democrats or liberals conceding the moral issues to the conservatives, I think it's more than a matter of concession. I think you're talking about, in the courts and in the media, a direct attack against religion. It's not a matter of abandoning religion, but you see an attack against religion in public life in many court decisions, in the media with the promotion of pornography and sexual immorality on TV and other vehicles. And so it's not just a matter of concession. It's a matter of actually an attack by the secular media and by the courts. And these are my two comments.
Okay. Well, let's get a response from the guests, because certainly those are some of the kind of things that the caller have said, clearly are some of the kind of criticisms that people on the right, conservative Christians, have talked about, particularly the second point that the caller made.
Sure. Well, on those two points, first of all, I think if we're going to look at which issues are most clear-cut in the Bible, I would say that poverty is much more clear. The overwhelming 3,000 verses, and the topic verses 10 or 12 on homosexuality, and those are often not even clear. So there really is a pretty clear-cut issue. The prophets make clear how we treat the most vulnerable is the best test of a nation's righteousness. So what solutions are, I agree the caller's right, how do you find effective solutions? How do you help families escape poverty? That means a multi-sector approach. I don't think government can do it all. It's private sector, public sector, nonprofit organizations, faith-based organizations. Lots of us can help make this happen. But the Bible is pretty clear about the issue of poverty being very central and close to God's heart. The issue of war is always complicated, and as the caller said, the just war theory, you know, it has to be applied. But in this case, he mentioned the Pope was against the war. That's true. So were most Christian bodies around the world. Outside the U.S., including most evangelical Christian bodies around the world, in the U.K. and Australia, other places, decided the war in Iraq was not a just war, was not a last resort. Despite Saddam's brutality and hideous dictatorship, there were no weapons of mass destruction. There was no connection to Al-Qaeda and 9/11. And, you know, there are other dictatorships. And what about Darfur and Rwanda and Congo? And you know, this war really didn't fit. Most Christians around the world outside the U.S. decided this war didn't fit just war category. So it is complicated, but we have to apply these principles and see how it comes out. On the second point, I think the caller is right. I've been critical of the kind of religious fundamentalism, having too much influence, if you will, in the Republican Party, but there's a kind of secular fundamentalism that is too much influence in the Democratic Party. Nothing wrong with being secular. Religion doesn't have a monopoly on morality. That should be clear. But when there's a secular disdain for religion and for people of faith, which I think is true in some of our institutions, some place in the media, some place in the courts, that there's some truth to that. So how do we find a more balanced kind of level playing field in where we believe in the separation of church and state, which I do, but we call for kind of pluralism, where faith is respected but not established, and all religions are protected, and people who don't have any faith at all, they're protected too.
Well, I want to thank the caller for his comments. I have a lot of other people here, and I hope you'll forgive me if I want to go on and get some others.
Sure.
Let's go to Champagne in line 3 next. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
Great to hear this conversation. I've been listening to it for about the past 30 minutes or so, and I just had a more general question for Mr. Wallace. He's already sort of partially answered it in talking about social movements, but my question was, when I read the Gospels and especially look at Jesus and his behavior and his teachings, it seems like a lot of the time Jesus really isn't all that concerned with the political situation around him. And there are lots of instances where political or community leaders, even religious leaders, try and sort of corner him and label him as either a revolutionary or, you know, give him some kind of political label, and he is always very good at resisting that. He doesn't even apply the label Messiah to himself because it's a political label that was employed at the time. And you know, when he's brought before the courts, he doesn't even, you know, answer the politicians that are accusing him for the most part. And so my general question for Jim is, you know, to what extent should Christians be directly engaging politicians or the political culture, or, you know, directly involved in politics in general, as opposed to, say, the more general grassroots social movements that he was talking about before? And I just wondered if you could discuss that a little bit.
Good question. Jesus rejected the principal political options of his day. One was collaboration, one was sort of withdrawal, one was a kind of moving into a kind of a personal piety that ignored politics, and one was the what was then the zealot option, the revolutionary option, to overthrow the existing order. Those were all very live options. He rejected them all. Instead, talked about the kingdom of God, a new way of living, a new way of being, and this new social reality, which became the church, about a community of people living by whole different values. Yet those values really turn the society upside down. Blessed are the poor in spirit. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for justice. Those blessed are the peacemakers. All these have real implications politically. They're not a party, not a not a revolutionary movement, but they're things that change a society. And then after Jesus, the churches have been involved in all kinds of things that have changed society, ended slavery and civil rights and Desmond Tutu in South Africa and all kinds of movements that changed the society based on the values and the teachings of Jesus. So I think it's deeper than just partisan politics, and that's why I'm nervous when churches get too partisan, or in fact, at all partisan, when they begin to choose one party over another and imply, as some churches do, that you can't be a Democrat and a Christian at the same time. That's what some people said last fall. God is not a Republican or a Democrat.
Right. Isn't there a real danger, though, in identifying those principles of the kingdom of God that Jesus taught about with a particular institution and saying, this is the kingdom of God?
Oh, sure, and you shouldn't do that. But you take those values, and then on the base of those values, you become a change agent in the society. So Martin King changed the society, and he was trying to make operational what the prophet said, what Jesus said. But he never even endorsed a candidate for the White House. He just had a movement, and he wanted them to endorse him or his movement. So I do believe that social movements are the things that make the greatest difference over time. They engage politics. They hold politics accountable. The slave trade, William Wilberforce, a convert to John Wesley's Methodist revival preaching, he became the British parliamentarian that led the battle against slavery as a Christian. But he wasn't just a partisan politician. He was kind of part of this movement that made a difference.
That's great. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Let's go to Chicago next. This is line 4. Hello.
Hello. I'm not sure if you talked about this at all, but my concern is the secularization of religion. And I'll give you two examples. One is what has clearly happened, especially in the news notices coming out from London, is the demonization of Islam, acting as Islam is the problem. And the other thing is the use of liberal and conservative when referring to religious persons. I think one of the callers previously called Pope John Paul conservative, which really obscures a lot of his beliefs. And I think that happens to all of us when they use those terms.
Mm-hmm.
And before you answer that question, I just wanted to thank the staff of Focus 580 because they have really focused on religion in general in these last days, trying to help people understand religion instead of demonizing Islam. But to me, it's very frightening as a Christian because there are so many problems within Christianity to the point we've almost forfeited our right to be evangelical,
mm-hmm.
And to have this focus on Islam, which I think is more a secular intent than looking at the true issues of religion, because if we were all really following our religion, there would not be terrorism.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, you raise a very good point about, you know, the politicizing of religion. I'm going to plug another book here. A young man I met on this book tour with a book of his own called, it's called Reza Aslan, and the book is called No God But God. And he's a Muslim, young Muslim, and he's talking about the battle for the heart and soul of Islam going on internally within Islam, between Islamic fundamentalists who resort to terrorism and violence and those who want a more democratic, compassionate, and even peaceful Islam. I think that battle is going on in all of our great religions, as the caller suggested, within Christianity, within Judaism, within Islam. And there's kind of a fundamentalism on the one side and a prophetic kind of faith on the other side. And that battle is going on in all of our traditions. And so when it gets politicized, and particularly when religion wants to take state power, I get very nervous about that. Theocracy is bad for religion and bad for the state and for a society. It takes religion in a very politicized direction, and it loses that prophetic role religion is supposed to have to critique all of politics.
We're at the point where, I'm sorry to say, we're going to have to stop and have a couple of calls we can't take. I actually do, since you mentioned Reza Aslan, I guess I do want to get in a plug for the fact that on our Afternoon Magazine program, another show we have here on WILL, a couple of months ago, he talked with Celeste Quinn, the host, about this book, No God But God. And if people want to hear the interview, they can go to our web archive and listen to it. So that'd be an opportunity to hear a little bit from him. We are indeed at the point where we're going to have to stop. So much more than we can say. If I just ask, you know, if I posed as a cynical kind of political consultant and said I was working for a Democratic candidate and I'm interested in how to deal with this whole values thing for my candidate, what would you say?
Well, again, I want to raise the values questions, and people often ask me at the end of these book events, which candidate do you think most represents, you know, the values and God's politics in the book? And I just say, it's really the wrong question. I do talk to the politicians, some of them, but I want to get them to move in the direction of these values and these fundamental issues of justice. And I say the civil rights movement didn't endorse candidates. They had candidates endorse their agenda. So how do we create the kind of momentum and movement and inspire people to really act on the basis of these values and then see politics change accordingly?
Well, I want to thank you, Mr. Wallace, very much for talking with us.
Great to be on your show.
Our guest, Jim Wallace. Once again, the book, if you're interested in reading it, is titled God's Politics, Why the Right Gets It Wrong and the Left Doesn't Get It. It's published by HarperCollins, came out a little bit earlier this year. Our guest is the founder of Sojourners, and more than 30 years ago, he also continues to serve as the editor of Sojourners magazine. He also was instrumental in forming Call to Renewal. That's a national federation of churches and faith-based organizations interested in getting together and working on the issue of poverty. Our program, Focus 580, made possible in part by a grant from Strawberry Fields in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields Catering Department now offers boxed lunches for professional meetings or casual lunchtime gatherings. Strawberry Fields, 328-1655. Programs also made possible by a grant from Christopher's Fine Jewelry Design, a gallery of imaginative jewelry and gift in downtown Champaign, offering one-of-a-kind custom design, gemstone round tables, and conflict-free diamonds direct from Canada. That's it for us here on Focus. We want you to stay tuned. Up next, it's the Afternoon Magazine. The host, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we will talk with naturalist, lawyer, and writer Joel Greenberg. He is the author of A Natural History of the Chicago Region. He'll join us following the 1 o'clock news. Let's take a look at prices now on the Chicago Board of Trade. Prices are up on the board and the Merc. September wheat trading at 333.5, up 3. December 347.5, up 2.25. September corn 240.5, up 4. December 251.75, up 4. March corn 258.5, up 3.25. May 262.5, up 3. August beans 685.5, up 11.75. September 690, up 12. November soybeans 698.75, up 12.